Cassette 19, side 2. Each kind of cell line aged at a different speed, or did not age at all. Thus, it wasn't just a matter of time in the sense of a kind of Newtonian absolute time, working entropically on an organism. There was no such time. Rather, it was a great many trains of specific physical and chemical events moving at different speeds and with varying effects. There was a fantastically large number of cell repair mechanisms inherent in any large organism and an immune system of great and various power. The longevity treatments often supplemented these processes or worked on them directly or replaced them. The treatment now included supplements of the enzyme photolyase to correct DNA damage and supplements of the pineal hormone melatonin and dehydroepiandrosterone, a steroid hormone produced by the adrenal glands. There were about 200 components like these in the longevity treatment now. So vast, so complex. Sometimes Sachs finished his day's reading and walked down to Odessa's seafront to sit on the Cornish with Maya, and he would pause in eating a burrito and stare at it, contemplate everything that went into its digestion. Everything that kept them alive, feel his breath, which he had never noted at all before, and suddenly he would feel breathless, lose his appetite, lose his belief that any such complex system could exist for more than a moment before collapsing into primordial chaos and the simplicities of astrophysics, like a house of cards 100 stories tall in a wind. Tap it anywhere. It was lucky Maya didn't require much in the way of active companionship, because often he was rendered speechless for many minutes at a time, wrapped in the contemplation of his own evident impossibility. But he persevered. This was what a scientist did, confronted with an enigma. And there were others helping in the search, working ahead of him on the frontiers, and beside him in related fields, from the small virology, where the inquiries into tiny forms such as prions and viroids were revealing even smaller forms, almost too partial to be called life. Virids, viris, virs, vis, vs, all of which might have relevance to the larger problem. All the way up to the large organismic issues, such as brainwave rhythms and their relationship to the heart and other organs, or the pineal gland's ever-decreasing secretions of melatonin, a hormone that seemed to regulate many aspects of aging. Sachs followed them all, trying to glean a new view by his later and hopefully larger perspective. He had to follow his intuition to what seemed important and study that. Of course, it didn't help that some of his best thoughts on the subject blanked out on him at the moment of completion. He had to be able to get these thought flurries recorded before they disappeared. He began to talk aloud to himself frequently, even in public situations, hoping that this would help to forestall the blanks. But again, it didn't work. It simply was not a verbal process. In all this work, the meetings with Maya were a pleasure. Every evening, if he noticed it was evening, he would stop reading and walk down the staircase streets of the town to the Cornish, and there, on one of four different benches, he would often see Maya sitting and looking out over the harbor to the sea. He would go to one of the food stands back in the park, buy a burrito or a gyro or a salad or a corn dog, and walk over and sit down next to her. She would nod, and they would eat without saying much. Afterward, they sat and watched the sea. How was your day? Okay, and yours? He didn't attempt to talk much about his reading, and she didn't say much about her hydrology or the theater productions that she would go off to after dusk had fallen. Really, they didn't have much to say to each other, but it was companionable anyway. And one evening, the sunset flared to an unusual lavender brilliance, and Maya said, "I wonder what color that is." And Sachs had ventured, "Lavender?" "But lavender is usually more pastel, isn't it?" Sachs called up a large color chart he had found long before to help him see the colors of the sky. Maya snorted at this, but he held his wrist up anyway and compared various sample squares to the sky. We need a bigger screen. And then they found one that they thought matched. Light violet, or somewhere between light violet and pale violet. And after that, they had a little hobby. Really, it was remarkable how varied the colors of the Odessa sunsets were, affecting sky, sea, the whitewashed walls of the town. Endless variation, much more variation than there were names. The poverty of language in this area was a constant surprise to Sachs, even the poverty of the color chart. The eye could perceive perhaps 10 million different shades, he read. The color handbook he was referring to had 1,266 samples in it, and only a very small fraction of these had names. So most evenings they held up their forearms and tried different colors against the sky, and found a patch that matched fairly well, and it was a nondescript, no name. They made up names. 2 October the 11th, orange. Aphelion purple, lemon leaf, almost green, Arcadi's beard. Maya could go on forever, she was really good at it. Then sometimes they would find a named patch matching the sky, for a moment anyway, and they would learn the real meaning of a new word, which Sachs found satisfying. But in that stretch between red and blue, English had surprisingly little to offer. The language just was not equipped for Mars. One evening in the dusk after a mauvish sunset, they went through the chart methodically just to see. Purple, magenta, lilac, amaranth, aubergine, mauve, amethyst, plum, violaceous, violet, heliotrope, clematis, lavender, indigo, hyacinth, ultramarine. And then they were into the many words for the blues. There were many, many blues. But for the red-blue span, that was it, except for the many modulations of the list, royal violet, lavender gray, and so on. One evening the sky was clear, and after the sun had gone down behind the Hellespontus Mountains, but was still illuminating the air over the sea, it turned a very familiar rusty brown orange. Maya seized his arm in her claw-like grip.
That's Martian orange. Look, that's the color of the planet from space, what we saw from the Ares. Look, quick! What color is that? What color is that?
They looked through the charts, arms held up before them. Paprika red.
Tomato red.
Oxide red. Now, that should be right. It's oxygen's affinity for iron that makes that color, after all.
But it's way too dark. Look.
True.
Brownish red.
Reddish brown. Cinnamon, raw sienna, Persian orange, sunburn, camel, rust brown, Sahara, chrome orange. They began to laugh. Nothing was quite right.
We'll call it Martian orange, Maya decided.
Fine. But look how many more names there are for these colors than there are for the purples. Why is that?
Maya shrugged.
Sachs went reading in the material accompanying the chart to see if they said anything about it. Ah, it appears that the rods in the retina tend to see best in the three primaries, and so colors around those three have lots of distinction, while those in between are composite. Then, in the empurpling dusk, he came on a sentence that surprised him so much he read it aloud. Redness and greenness form another pair which cannot be perceived simultaneously as components of the same color.
That's not true, Maya said immediately. That's just because they're using a color wheel, and those two are on opposite sides.
What do you mean? That there's more colors than these?
Of course, artist colors, theater colors. You put a green spot and a red spot on someone, and you get a color, all right, and it's not red or green.
But what is it? Does it have a name?
I don't know. Look in an artist's color wheel.
And so he did, and so did she. She found it first.
Here, burnt umber, Indian red, madder alizarin. Those are all green-red mixes.
Interesting. Red-green mixes. Don't you find that suggestive? She gave him a look.
We're talking about colors here, Sax, not politics.
I know, but still.
No, don't be silly.
But don't you think we need a red-green mix?
Politically? There's a red-green mix already, Sax. That's the trouble. Fremar's got the Reds on board to stop immigration. That's why they're having such success. They're teaming up and closing down Mars to Earth, and soon after that, we'll be at war with them again. I tell you, I can see it coming. We're spiraling down into it again.
Hmm, Sax said, sobered.
He wasn't paying attention to solar systemic politics these days, but he knew that Maya, who had a very sharp eye for these things, was getting more and more worried about it, with her usual mordant Mayan dash of satisfaction at the approach of crisis. So that it was perhaps not as bad as she thought. Probably he would have to look into it again soon, pay attention. But meanwhile, look, it's gone indigo right over the mountains. Intense saw edge of black below, purple-blue above.
That's not indigo, it's royal blue.
But they shouldn't call it blue if it's got some red in it. Shouldn't?
Look, marine blue, Prussian blue, King's blue, they all have red in them.
But that color on the horizon isn't any of those.
No, you're right. Nondescript.
They marked it on their charts. LS-24, M-Year 91, September 2206. A new color. And so another evening passed. Then one winter evening, they were sitting on the westernmost bench, in the hour before sunset, everything still, the Hellas sea like a plate of glass, the sky cloudless and clean, pure, transparent. And as the sun dropped, everything drifted over the spectrum into the blue, until Maya looked up from her salade niçoise and clutched Sax by the arm.
Oh, my God, look!
And she put her paper plate aside, and they both stood instinctively, like ancient veterans hearing the national anthem from an approaching parade. Sax swallowed hamburger in a lump.
Ah,
he said, and stared. Everything was blue. Sky blue, Terran sky blue, drenching everything for most of an hour, flooding their retinas and the nerve pathways in their brains, no doubt long starved for precisely that color, the home they had left forever. Those were pleasant evenings. By day, however, things got more and more complicated. Sax gave up studying whole-body problems, sharpened his focus to the brain alone. This was like having infinity, but still it cut down on the papers he had to look at, and it did seem like the brain was the heart of the problem, so to speak. There were changes in the hyper-aged brain, changes visible both on autopsy and during the various scans of blood flow. Electrical activity, protein use, sugar use, heat, and all the rest of the indirect tests they had managed to concoct through the centuries, studying the living brain during mental activity of every kind. Observed changes in the hyper-aged brain included calcification of the pineal gland, which reduced the amount of melatonin it produced. Synthetic melatonin supplements were part of the longevity treatment, but of course it would be better to stop the calcification from occurring in the first place, for it probably had other effects. Then there was a clear growth in the number of neurofibrillary tangles, which were protein filament aggregates that grew between neurons, exerting physical pressure on them, perhaps the analog of the pressure Maya reported feeling during her presque-vue, who could say. Then again, beta-amyloid protein accumulated in the cerebral blood vessels and in the extracellular space around nerve terminals, again impeding function. And pyramidal neurons in the frontal cortex and the hippocampus accumulated calpain, which meant they were vulnerable to calcium influxes which damaged them. And these were non-dividing cells, the same age as the organism itself. Damage to them was permanent, as during Sax's stroke. He had lost a lot of his brain in that incident. He didn't like to think of it. And the ability of the molecules in these non-dividing cells to replace themselves could also be damaged. A smaller, but over time equally significant, loss. Autopsies of people over 200 who had died of the quick decline regularly showed serious calcification of the pineal gland, coupled with increases in calpain levels in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus and calpain levels generally were both implicated in some of the leading current models of how the memory worked. It was an interesting connection, but all inconclusive. And no one was going to solve the mystery by literature review alone. But the experiments that might clear things up were not practical given the inaccessibility of the living brain. You could kill chicks and mice and rats and dogs and pigs and lemurs and chimps. You could kill individuals of every species in creation, dissect the brains of their fetuses and embryos as well, and still never find what you were looking for it was autopsy itself that was insufficient to the task. And the various live scans were likewise insufficient to the task, as the processes involved were either more fine-grained than the scans could perceive, or more holistic, or more combinatorial, or probably all three at once. Still, some of the experiments and the resultant modeling were suggestive. Calpain buildup seemed to alter brainwave function, for instance, and this fact and others gave him ideas for further investigation. He began to read intensively in the literature on the effects of calcium-binding protein levels, on corticosteroids, on the calcium currents in the hippocampal pyramidal neurons, and on the calcification of the pineal gland. It appeared there were synergistic effects that might impact both memory and general brainwave function, indeed all bodily rhythms, including heart rhythms. "Was Michel experiencing any memory troubles?" Sax asked Maya, perhaps feeling that he had lost entire trains of thought, even very useful trains of thought. Maya shrugged. By now, Michel was almost a year gone.
"I can't remember."
It made Sax nervous. Maya seemed in retreat, her memory worse every day. Even Nadia could do nothing for her. Sax met her down on the Corniche more and more frequently. It was a habit they both clearly must have enjoyed, though they never spoke of that. They simply sat, ate a kiosk meal, watched the sunset, and pulled up their color charts to see if they could catch another new one. But if it weren't for the notations they made on the charts, neither of them would have been sure whether the colors they saw were new or not. Sax himself felt that he was experiencing his blankouts more frequently, perhaps some 4 to 8 a day, although he couldn't be sure. He took to keeping his AI running a sound recorder permanently, activated by voice, and rather than try to describe his complete train of thought, he just spoke a few words that he hoped would later key a fuller recollection of what he had been thinking. Thus, at the end of the day, he would sit down apprehensively or hopefully and listen to what the AI had captured during the day. And mostly it was thought that he remembered thinking, but occasionally he would hear himself say, "Synthetic melatonins may be a better antioxidant than natural ones, so that there aren't enough free radicals." Or, "Viriditas is a fundamental mystery. There will never be a grand unified theory," without having any memory of saying such things, or often what they might mean. But sometimes the statements were suggestive, their meanings excavatable. And so he struggled on. And as he did, he saw it anew, as fresh as in his undergraduate days. The structure of science was so beautiful. It was surely one of the greatest achievements of the human spirit, a kind of stupendous Parthenon of the mind, constantly a work in progress, like a symphonic epic poem of thousands of stanzas being composed by them all in a giant ongoing collaboration. The language of the poem was mathematics, because this appeared to be the language of nature itself. There was no other way to explain the startling adherence of natural phenomena to mathematical expressions of great difficulty and subtlety. And so, in this marvelous family of languages, their songs explored the various manifestations of reality in the different fields of science, and each science worked up its standard model to explain things, all constellating at some distance around the basics of particle physics, depending on what level or scale was being investigated, so that all the standard models hopefully interlocked in a coherent, larger structure. These standard models were somewhat like Kuhnian paradigms, but in reality, paradigms being a model of modeling, more supple and various, a dialogic process in which thousands of minds had participated over the previous hundreds of years, so that figures like Newton or Einstein or Vlad were not the isolate giants of public perception, but the tallest peaks of a great mountain range, as Newton himself had tried to make clear with his comment about standing on the shoulders of giants. In truth, the work of science was a communal thing, extending back even beyond the birth of modern science, back all the way into prehistory, as Michel had insisted, a constant struggle to understand. Now, of course, it was highly structured, articulated beyond the ability of any single individual to fully grasp, but this was only because of the sheer quantity of it. The spectacular efflorescence of structure was not in any particular incomprehensible. One could still walk around anywhere inside the Parthenon, so to speak, and thus comprehend at least the shape of the whole, and make choices as to where to study, where to learn the current surface, where to contribute. One could first learn the dialect of the language relevant to the study, which in itself could be a formidable task, as in superstring theory or cascading recombinant chaos. Then one could survey the background literature and hopefully find some syncretic work by someone who had worked long on the cutting edge and was able to give a coherent account of the status of the field for outsiders. This work, disparaged by most working scientists, called the gray literature, and considered a vacation or a lowering of oneself on the part of the synthesist, was nevertheless often of great value for someone coming in from the outside. With a general overview, though it was better to think of it as an underview, with the actual workers up there lost in the dim rafters and entablatures of the edifice, one could then move up into the journals, the peer-reviewed white literature, where the current work was being recorded, and one could read the abstracts and get a sense of who was attacking what part of the problem. So public, so explicit. And for any given problem in science, the people who were actually out there on the edge making progress constituted a special group of a few hundred at most, often with a core group of synthesists and innovators that was no more than a dozen people in all the worlds, inventing a new jargon of their dialect to convey their new insights, arguing over results, suggesting new avenues of investigation, giving each other jobs in labs, meeting at conferences specially devoted to the topic, talking to each other in all the media there were. And there in the labs and the conference bars, the work went forward as a dialogue of people who understood the issues and did the sheer hard work of experimentation and of thinking about experiments. And all this vast, articulated structure of a culture stood out in the open sun of day, accessible to anyone who wanted to join, who was willing and able to do the work. There were no secrets, there were no closed shops, and if every lab and every specialization had its politics, that was just politics. And in the end, politics could not materially affect the structure itself, the mathematical edifice of their understanding of the phenomenal world. So Sachs had always believed, and no analysis by social scientists nor even the troubling experience of the Martian terraforming process had ever caused him to waver in that belief. Science was a social construct, but it was also, and most importantly, its own space, conforming to reality only. That was its beauty. Truth is beauty, as the poet had said, speaking of science. And it was. The poet had been right. They weren't always. And so Sachs moved about in the great structure, comfortable, capable, and on some levels, content.
But he began to understand that as beautiful and powerful as science was, the problem of biological senescence was perhaps too difficult. Not too difficult to be solved ever, nothing was that, but simply too difficult to be solved in his lifetime. Actually, it was still an open question how hard a problem it was. Their understanding of matter, space, and time was incomplete, and it might be that it would always necessarily shade off into metaphysics, like the speculations about the cosmos before the Big Bang, or things smaller than strings. On the other hand, the world might be amenable to progressive explanations until it all, at least from string to cosmos, would be brought some day within the realm of the great Parthenon. Either result was possible. The court was still out. The next 1,000 years or so should tell the tale. But in the meantime, he was experiencing several blackouts a day, and sometimes he was short of breath. Sometimes his heart seemed to beat so hard. Seldom did he sleep at night, and Michel was dead, so that Sax's sense of the meaning of things was becoming uncertain and in great need of help. When he managed to think at all on the level of meaning, he found that he felt he was in a race. Him and everyone else, but especially the life scientists actually at work on the problem, they were in a race with death. To win it, they had to explain one of the greatest of the great unexplainables. And one day, sitting down on a bench with Maya after a day in front of his screen, thinking of the vastness of that growing wing of the Parthenon, he realized that it was a race he couldn't win. The human species might win it some day, but it looked to be a long way off still. It was no great surprise, really. He knew this. That is to say, he had always known it. Labeling the current largest manifestation of the problem had not disguised to him its profundity. The quick decline was just a name, inaccurate, oversimple. Not science, in fact, but rather an attempt, like the Big Bang, to diminish and contain the reality, as yet not understood. In this case, the problem was simply death. A quick decline, indeed. And given the nature of life and of time, this was a problem that no living organism would ever truly solve. Postponements, yes. Solutions, no. Reality itself is mortal, he said. Of course, Maya said, absorbed in the sight of the sunset. He needed a simpler problem, as a postponement, as a step toward the harder problems, or just as something he could solve. Memory, perhaps. Fighting the blankouts. It was certainly a problem that stood at hand, ready for study. His memory was in need of help. Working on it might even cast light on the quick decline. And even if it didn't, he had to try it, no matter how hard. Because they were all going to die. But they could at least die with their memories intact. So he switched his emphasis to the memory problem, abandoning the quick decline and all the rest of the senescence issues. He was only mortal, after all. Recent memory work was fairly suggestive of avenues of approach. This particular scientific front was related in some of its aspects to the work on learning that had enabled Sax to, partially, recover from his stroke. This wasn't surprising, as memory was the retention of learning. All brain science tended to move together in its understanding of consciousness. But in that progression, retention and recall remained recalcitrant crux issues, still imperfectly understood. But there were indications, and more all the time. Clinical clues. A lot of the ancient ones were experiencing memory problems of varying kinds, and behind the ancient ones came a giant generation of Nisei who could see the problems manifesting in their elders and hope to avoid them, so memory was a hot topic. Hundreds, indeed thousands, of labs were working on it in one way or another, and as a result, many aspects of it were coming clear. Sax immersed himself in the literature in his usual style, reading intensively for several months on end. And at the end of that time, he thought he could say, in general terms, how memory worked.
Although in the end, he, like all the rest of the scientists working on the problem, ran into their insufficient understanding of the underlying basics of consciousness, matter, time. And at this point, as detailed as their understanding was, Sachs couldn't see how memory might be improved or reinforced. They needed something more. The original Hebb hypothesis, first proposed by Donald Hebb in 1949, was still held to be true because it was such a general principle. Learning changed some physical feature in the brain, and after that the changed feature somehow encoded the event learned. In Hebb's time, the physical feature, the engram, was conceived of as occurring somewhere on the synaptic level, and as there could be hundreds of thousands of synapses for each of the 10 billion neurons in the brain, this gave researchers the impression that the brain might be capable of holding some 10^14 data bits. At the time, this seemed more than adequate to explain human consciousness. And as it was also within the realm of the possible for computers, it led to a brief vogue in the notion of strong artificial intelligence, as well as that era's version of the machine fallacy, an inverse of the pathetic fallacy in which the brain was thought of as being something like the most powerful machine of the time. The work of the 21st and 22nd century, however, had made it clear that there were no specific engram sites as such. Any number of experiments failed to locate these sites, including one in which various parts of rats' brains were removed after they learned a task, with no part of the brain proving essential. The frustrated experimenters concluded that memory was everywhere and nowhere, leading to the analogy of brain to hologram, even sillier than all the other machine analogies. But they were stumped. They were flailing. Later experiments clarified things. It became obvious that all the actions of consciousness were taking place on a level far smaller even than that of neurons. This was associated in Sachs's mind with the general miniaturization of scientific attention through the 22nd century. In that finer-grained appraisal, they had begun investigating the cytoskeletons of neuron cells, which were internal arrays of microtubules with protein bridges between the microtubules. The microtubules' structure consisted of hollow tubes made of 13 columns of tubulin dimers, peanut-shaped protein pairs, each about 8x4x4 nanometers, existing in two different configurations, depending on their electrical polarization. So the dimers represented a possible on-off switch of the hoped-for engram, but they were so small that the electrical state of each dimer was influenced by the dimers around it because of van der Waals interactions between them. So messages of all kinds could be propagated along each microtubule column and along the protein bridges connecting them. Then, most recently, had come yet another step in miniaturization. Each dimer contained about 450 amino acids, which could retain information by changes in the sequences of amino acids. And contained inside the dimer columns were tiny threads of water in an ordered state, a state called vicinal water, and this vicinal water was capable of conveying quantum coherent oscillations for the length of the tubule. A great number of experiments on living monkey brains with miniaturized instrumentation of many different kinds had established that while consciousness was thinking, amino acid sequences were shifting. Tubulin dimers in many different places in the brain were changing configuration in pulsed phases. Microtubules were moving, sometimes growing, and on a much larger scale, dendrite spines then grew and made new connections, sometimes changing synapses permanently, sometimes not. So now the best current model had it that memories were encoded, somehow, as standing patterns of quantum coherent oscillations set up by changes in the microtubules and their constituent parts, all working in patterns inside the neurons. Although there were now researchers who speculated that there could be significant action at even finer ultramicroscopic levels, permanently beyond their ability to investigate, familiar refrain. Some saw traces of signs that the oscillations were structured in the kind of spin network patterns that Bao's work described, in knotted nodes and networks that Sachs found eerily reminiscent of the Palace of Memory plan, rooms and hallways, as if the ancient Greeks by introspection alone had intuited the very geometry of time-space. In any case, it was sure that these ultramicroscopic actions were implicated in the brain's plasticity. They were part of how the brain learned and then remembered. So memory was happening at a far smaller level than had been previously imagined, which gave the brain a much higher computational possibility than before, up to perhaps 10 to the 24th power operations per second, or even 10 to the 43 power in some calculations, leading one researcher to note that every human mind was in a certain sense more complicated than all the rest of the universe. Minus its other consciousnesses, of course. Sachs found this suspiciously like the strong anthropic phantom seen elsewhere in cosmological theory, but it was an interesting idea to contemplate. So, not only was there simply more going on, it was also happening at such fine levels that quantum effects were certainly involved. Experimentation had made it clear that large-scale collective quantum phenomena were happening in every brain. There existed in the brain both global quantum coherence and quantum entanglement between the various electrical states of the microtubules, and this meant that all the counterintuitive phenomena and sheer paradox of quantum reality were an integral part of consciousness. Indeed, it was only very recently, by including the quantum effects in the cytoskeletons, that a team of French researchers had finally managed to put forth a plausible theory as to why general anesthetics worked after all the centuries of blithely using them. So they were confronted with yet another bizarre quantum world, in which there was action at a distance, in which decisions not made could affect events that really happened, in which certain events seemed to be triggered teleologically. That is to say, by events that appeared to come after them in time. Sachs was not greatly surprised by this development. It supported a feeling he had had all his life, that the human mind was deeply mysterious, a black box that science could scarcely investigate. And now that science was investigating it, it was coming up hard against the great unexplainables of reality itself. Still, one could hold to what science had learned, and admit that reality at the quantum level behaved in ways that were simply outrageous at the level of human senses and ordinary experience. They had had 300 years to get used to that, and eventually they had to somehow incorporate this knowledge into their world views and forge on. Sachs would have indeed said that he was comfortable with the familiar quantum paradoxes. Things at the micro scale were bizarre but explicable, quantifiable or at least describable, using complex numbers, Riemannian geometry, and all the rest of the armatures of the appropriate branches of mathematics. Finding such stuff in the very workings of the brain should have been no surprise at all. Indeed, compared to things like human history or psychology or culture, it was even somehow comforting. It was only quantum mechanics, after all. Something that could be modeled by mathematics. And that was saying something. So, at an extremely fine level of structure in the brain, much of one's past was contained, encoded in a unique complex network of synapses, microtubules, dimers, and vicinal water and amino acid chains, all small enough and near enough together to have quantum effects on each other. Patterns of quantum fluctuation. Diverging and collapsing. This was consciousness. And the patterns were clearly held or generated in specific parts of the brain. They were the result of a physical structure articulated on many levels. The hippocampus, for instance, was critically important, especially the dentate gyrus region and the perforant pathway nerves that led to it. And the hippocampus was extremely sensitive to action in the limbic system directly underneath it in the brain. And the limbic system was in many ways the seat of the emotions, what the ancients would have called the heart. Thus, the emotional charge of an event had much to do with how fully it was laid out in the memory. Things happened, and the consciousness witnessed or experienced them, And inevitably, a great deal of this experience changed the brain and became part of it forever, particularly the events heightened by emotion. This description seemed right to Sachs. What he had felt most, he remembered best, or forgot most assiduously, as certain experiments suggested, with an unconscious constant effort that was not true forgetting at all, but repression. After that initial change in the brain, however, the slow process of degradation began. For one thing, the power of recollection was different in different people, but always less powerful than memory storage, it appeared, and very hard to direct. So much was patterned into the brain, but never retrieved, and then if one never remembered a pattern, never recollected and rehearsed it, then they never got the reinforcement of another run-through. And after about 150 years of storage, experiments suggested, the pattern began to degrade more and more rapidly, due apparently to the accumulated quantum effects of free radicals collecting randomly in the brain. This was apparently what was happening to the ancient ones, a breakdown process which began immediately after an event was patterned into the brain, eventually hit a cumulative level where the effects were catastrophic for the oscillatory patterns involved, and thus for the memories. It was probably about as clock-like, Sachs thought glumly, as the thermodynamic clouding of the lens of the eye.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 19 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 20.